No, I mean, architecture is political. We gotta add that stuff.
Indeed.
We're tearing down communities to build multifamily, and you have to understand we are creating displacement. You're displacing Black and Brown folks, and they don't come back.
Half of this podcast would be dedicated to the history of Tyler House, my journey and my discoveries, and hey, I'm gonna solve this housing problem.
Hey guys, what's up? My name is Melissa Daniels. This is the Architecturalist Political Podcast, where Black and Brown folks talk about architecture. I hope you enjoyed this podcast and be part of my storytelling. I attended the NOMA conference recently in Portland, Oregon, and this is by far one of the best conferences I've attended to yet. It was also one of their largest, and it felt that way. There was a lot of familiar faces, and a lot of new faces as well. According to the conference goers, there were over 600 students there, and I was just blown by that. I think they said it was like 1,300 or 1,400 in attendance this year. And what made the NOMA conference great was the sessions. So many yummy, I'm gonna use the word yummy topics. I even got a chance to meet some of people who were on the podcast, so shout out to them, as well as upcoming ones, which I'm so excited to talk to and for you to listen to as well. But overall, it was a really solid conference. And next year, it'll be in Baltimore. So hopefully I'll have some type of hand in that. So our guest today is, his name is Wynn Thomas Jr. He was a co-contact, as I mentioned in this episode. And I always like the get to know yous conversation because you learn so much and you end up going places that you obviously did not know you were going to go. And listening back to these episodes, I've noticed a correlation. And the correlation is bravery. And I wrote on my notes, bravery, and it's probably a better word for it. But I've noticed that there's a point in our lives, you went through architecture school and you graduated and now you could do anything. You'll go anywhere. You're bright-eyed. You take risk. And Wynn did that. So he graduated from architectural school from Louisiana, and he hopped in his Corolla and drove cross-country to California because that's where he wanted to go. And I think about myself, and I think about all of the other amazing people that are in my life who have done the same thing, who lived on the East Coast and traveled to the West Coast, or lived in the East Coast and went to the Midwest, or just got the hell out of where they were and just left and essentially didn't look back. I think about Devin Pena, and she went all over, but the amazing thing is she was like, I want to do this and I'm going to do this. So she went North Carolina to Texas. And then from Texas, she's like, I'm going to find my ancestral roots, and went to Cape Verde and then did this whole world tour for like a year. It's bravery, right? Like I ran back home. That's my story. I ran back home because I was defeated. But to those who felt stuck, who just felt that there's more than where I'm at right now, it's just amazing to me. And now, you know, we're older, right? We're more aware of things and we're kind of stable. What do you do? I think about my life right now and I think about where I'm at and would I get up and move across country? And, you know, now it's not just me I got to think about, but if my partner and I wanted to do that, would I be up to it? Leave my comforts of my job and the home that I've created to start anew when nobody knows me? Would I do that now in this day and age? I don't know. because you're comfortable, right? You're settled. You have your friends. You have your job. Would you do that again? I would like to see where Wynn is 10 years from now. And would he pick up and move someplace else? Or is he a Californian forever? And he has roots now. Like, it's not just him. But I'm curious, like, would he do that? And, you know, like, who knows? Who knows? In the sense of, like, architecture and how, like, architecture school is, you're done, right? And you're just like, oh, your life begins now. You say that to you, like, my life starts now. And I'm going to do all the steps that it takes to do it. And then you're just going to go for it. And I don't know. Is this something special about that time of your life? For me, it was not special at all. It was more agonizing than anything else. I was still like trying to find, I still hated architecture, but you guys know the story of that already. And if you don't, listen to this couple of episodes, prior episodes to find out my own story. But it was a great conversation. I enjoyed talking to him and hope you enjoy listening too. So here you go. All right. Wynn, how you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm doing awesome.
Well, thank you so much for joining me on this podcast. And this is a cold contact, just to let the audience know, because I have no idea who Mr. Wynn Thomas Jr. is, other than that someone recommended him to me. And usually the person who recommends me people has a stellar reputation for this podcast. So Wynn, who are you, sir?
Yeah. So maybe first off, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. And thank you for giving me the opportunity to interview with you and tell you a little bit about myself and about the things that I do. I myself, I'm a Southerner. So I grew up, I was born and raised in Louisiana. So a little small, quaint town called Franklin, Louisiana, actually. For those who may not know that are listening in, if you draw a line straight through the middle of the map, middle of Louisiana, where you hit the Gulf of Mexico, that's basically the region that I'm from. So I grew up there, very small. Everybody knew everybody. So you can take it however you want, but everybody definitely knew everyone. So it was a family type of vibe that we got there. So I do architecture. I am currently in my role, I am a project manager and as well as a project coordinator for co-architects here in Los Angeles. And I've always known that I wanted to become an architect. So from a very early age, I remember myself utilizing whatever my dad had. If he left paper around, I was using that paper to build my little loose leaf. Maybe that's an old term, but loose leaf paper to build my homes, construction paper to build my homes. So I remember doing that. Given my dad's kind of engineering background and planning background, I used to think that that was a major factor as to why I kind of got into architecture. However, as I've grown and as I've progressed into my career, I'm starting to realize that a lot of it has to also do with my upbringing, but as well as my localized environment. So for instance, my parents always instilled in us like a mentality as far as we should always transcend our environment. We should protect those we love. And we should better those around us. So if we lived by those things, we would do great in life. So, but growing up, there were definitely some challenges that arose. So there was the nice side of town. There's always two sides of a town, usually, no matter where you go. There was the area in which was pretty nice going around downtown where you would hit the bayou. For those that don't know, bayou, that's just a river, a source of water going through. That was the nicer side of town, going towards downtown Franklin, Louisiana. And when you would go across the tracks, you would see a big disparity between the facilities as well as the localized environment. And that's where I grew up. So I grew up, I was surrounded by canes. We had the local public housing projects, as we called it. And I grew up in a small mobile home all throughout my education experience. I grew up there in that mobile home. And then just seeing that the disparity there, I've kind of noticed that I always found myself thinking that, okay, what would I do here? Maybe I would design this. Maybe I would place this building differently here. Or maybe I would design this room differently. Or how would I design this building in which I can engage my local community, my friends, my family? I started thinking through that from an early age too as well. And so I think that kind of progressed to keep me focused on wanting to do architecture. I know I'm a bit long-winded. That's just how we Southerners are.
Which is perfect for a podcast.
Okay. But what I kind of realized is that thinking through architecture and just thinking through knowledge, that I noticed that knowledge is wealth, right? So I know that if my dad hadn't exposed me to the construction field from an early age, I wouldn't have known what architecture is. I didn't have, in high school, it was a very, very small high school, 500 people, maybe max, 100 people in my graduating class. So it was super small. And so we didn't have programs that would trade-focused programs that allowed us. We just typically taught English, economics, math. Those are the things that we typically done. There was, and maybe we may have a home economics class, but that was as far as the trades kind of went into. And so you can imagine I was kind of a little bit of deer in the headlights. So I was like, okay, do I even know what architecture really is once I got to school? So I went to Louisiana State University, and understanding like how I grew up as far as like some of those challenges, as far as just noticing the disparity between the lack of representation of minorities in my architectural class, and then seeing how that kind of transpired in my total graduation class from Louisiana State. I think there were three or four minority representatives. So while I was there, I did participate in NOMAS. So that was also nice to just to make that connection with other minority representation. But also I noticed how that kind of also translated to the working environment too. So it's been a process, but I've definitely enjoyed my time thus far in the architecture field. And I think that I found a great home at Co-Architects.
So let's go back. In your high school, were you the minority or the majority?
So at my high school, we were the majority. So okay. It was mostly those of African-American heritage or European heritage.
Okay. And so when you went to Louisiana State, obviously, that's a huge school. You were the minority in architecture school. How did you handle that? Was it hard?
I felt like it wasn't hard because I just felt like no matter the case, how I always was driven, I didn't necessarily look at that as a disadvantage. I just looked at it as an opportunity to work hard, put my head down in a sense, but also make myself known through my work ethic. And then also through, just showing what I can do given the circumstances that I've been presented with. But there were definitely some challenges along the way, which is why I tried to connect with NOMAS, for instance, National Organization of Minority Architecture Students. So I found that to be quite eventful and quite helpful, especially when I started to join in on some of the conferences and make those connections.
So how did you get from Louisiana across the country to California IA? How did you do that?
I'm going to try to give you a summarized version. I remember once that I visited California, right? And this was Northern California, to be exact. So the Bay Area. And I remember visiting, I was like, wow, this place is beautiful. And then also from my own standpoint, I wanted to just to live in a place that was just totally a little bit opposite of where I kind of grew up. So I wanted a place that was super diverse. I also wanted to focus on the type of architecture, like these bigger, larger projects. That was kind of like one of my goals as well. So I was interested in those items. I remember I was set on that. And I remember this was at the time I had graduated. I remember working during the summer just to save up some money. And I had it in my mind that I was going to move to California no matter what. That's just who I am. Once I have something in my mind and once I have a goal in mind, I don't stop striving for that goal until I do that. And I always say, look at it this way, who better to bet on other than yourself? So I decided to make that move. And I remember telling my mom and my dad, so we're a closely knit family. And I remember going up to my mom and dad's like, look, I know this may not be the appropriate time to move, but I'm moving to California. I was like, okay, son. I was pretty adamant about it. He's like, okay, son, if you want to go ahead and do that, we support you no matter what. But the conundrum that I had was that I didn't have a job set up. I didn't have a place to stay or anything like that. But I just knew that if I didn't make this move, that I just didn't want to be back home stuck doing something that I don't love doing. So I just packed up everything that I could in my little Toyota Corolla. I still have it and I still drive it to this day. It's been very good to me.
Shout out to Toyota Corollas, because I had one for like since 05.
Yeah, mine since 07. Since 07 for mine. It got me to California. I stopped only once. I'll probably never do this drive again because it was quite the drive.
Oh, that's brutal.
It was definitely brutal, especially going through the west side of Texas.
And you were like, alone?
Nothing. I was alone. I just popped my instrumental in my car. And I was like, okay, I need to do something. I'm not a freestyler, but I was like, I need to do some music, something to kind of keep me up. That's what I did. And also, my parents would call me just to check on me every now and then. So that was helpful too, as well, to kind of keep me up on the road and keep me safe. So I make it to California. And I spent maybe the first couple weeks, a few weeks, staying in a hotel that gets expensive. So I noticed that was eating through my money. And I was like, okay, I need to figure out a way to save money and find a place to stay in the meantime. So what I did was that I had a gym membership. I was like, okay, I can utilize that for my toiletries and necessities. And so I literally slept in my car. So I did that. But within a month, I found a job. And then as well as I had a place to stay within that month.
Was it an architecture job?
In 2011, that was during the height of the recession, right? So to find a job in the architecture field, and then also given that I didn't have any internship experience, only I lacked experience, basically, essentially. So most people did not want to take the opportunity or chance on me. So what I did was that, okay, it's like, okay, how can I find a job that correlates with what I would like to do? So what I did was that I started working for, this is a shout out to Academy of Art University. It gave me like my first job in California, in the Bay Area. So I started working for Academy of Art University, and I actually started working for the School of Architecture. So they gave me the opportunity. It's like, okay, we can have you work here. You can work for the School of Architecture. You can help us out administratively. And then also you can help us out with thinking through some design ideas for our studio layout. So they gave me that opportunity there to do so. So I started doing that. And then eventually I moved onward to the Academy Resource Tutoring System, which kind of plays into like my community connection, wanting to make connections with other students. They also allowed me to realms to also set up their layout of how they want to lay out their rooms for tutoring. So it was mostly like some interior design. So I took that and I took the opportunity to do so. And then from there, how did I get into actually the architecture field? Kenneth Park Architects, they decided to take a chance on me as an office administrator, but also as an office coordinator to potentially assist with projects too as well. So I took that opportunity and I had to kind of work my way up through that. But I utilized that process everywhere I've gone. I've made sure that my focus has always been architecture related somehow. And then I've progressed within the industry to where I am now at Co-Architects as a project manager.
So let me get this straight. After you graduated from school, you were like, I have this California dream. And so then you hopped in your Corolla and you drove in cross country, and then you had no plan.
No plan other than I'm doing this.
And then what part of California were you?
Well, I was working in downtown San Francisco. And then I was living in the East Bay, so Pittsburgh, minus the H, in the East Bay, Pittsburgh, California.
And how long did you do this?
I was there for about 4 years, 4 or 5 years.
And when did you get your first place or first roommate, or how did you stop sleeping in your car?
Okay, so my first roommate was actually this older lady. She decided to take a chance on me. I rented a room from her. I still remember her to this day, Miss Arlene Walker. She helped me out immensely. She took a chance on me. She's like, okay, I'll rent out a room to you. I still, to this day, every now and then, I'll check in on her just to kind of express my gratitude to her in helping me and giving me my first place to stay. But I did that. Some of my friends, the friends that I did make there, would make fun of me. It's like, oh, that's your grandma. It's like, yeah, she's like a grandmother to me. She literally took me under her wing. She'll show me some things that she would cook. And then I think she had family in France from Louisiana. And so I would also cook for her too. So I remember she had her little dog named Kiki. I'm just trying to give everyone, paint a little picture for the listeners. She had a little dog named Kiki and things like that. It was a good experience. It wasn't one of those experiences where I just went into my room and I closed the door and then I just went to work and then I was back home. I made connections with her. Her grandchildren were right around my age. So I would go on the weekends. We would go and play sports. It was a good experience. I'll definitely remember that for a long time, probably for the remainder of my life. Definitely remember that.
Yeah. So you built a family there.
Yes, I did.
Fast forward to, how did you find out about Co? You saw an application, a job opening, and you're like, I'm going to go for it. Like, how did you?
I was just doing a job application search. And then at the time, Co-Architects was Anson and Allen. So I was just trying to find a firm that did community involved work that helped to better the local community in the local environment. So Anson and Allen kind of piqued my interest. I was persistent. I've always been persistent. I applied a few times. I didn't hear back a few times, but I was like, okay, I know Co is a great firm. I keep hearing great things about it. I know at the time it was Anson and Allen, but I know that this place was a great place. So how I got in was that I had worked at another firm with one of my colleagues, and she actually provided a reference for me, and I got connected on with Co-Architects. So that happened in October of 2019 was when I officially had gotten hired. So I have been here going close to 4 years, almost there.
So let's stay on like community for a little bit. When you grew up in one area, you know, you're familiar with it and all that other stuff. And then you go to a completely different area. How did you start those connections? Because, you know, people talk differently. People cook differently. It's different rules, right? When we enter a community. So how did you navigate through that?
I've always been a pretty bold person. You can tell from me wanting to just say, I'm moving to California. That's what I'm going to do.
Right.
But sometimes what I would do is that sometimes if I saw a person sitting by themselves, I was like, hey, can I sit here? Can I talk to you? So depending on who the person was, some people were receptive to that. Then other people's like, yeah, this person's strange. What do they want from me? So what I did instead of that, once I realized that maybe some people just aren't comfortable with that approach, was that I kind of got involved with sports. So like intramural sports. I started to play like flag football, basketball. And so I did that to kind of make my connections. Outside of work, I made connections through networking, as far as just like if I go out and about and are going to hang out around town, then I would make connections that way, but also making connections through sports or extracurricular activity. But besides that, I also made connections while I was at work too as well.
Have you done any community projects or community engagement relating to architecture?
Yes, I'm glad you asked that. So right now, what I'm currently working on, and this is a project that's kind of close to my heart, is Charles Drew University. So maybe I could give the listeners kind of like a quick background on what, on who, first off, Charles or Richard Drew is, and then maybe secondly, talk about the project and its potential. And then given that, I'll kind of tie that back into how it kind of relates to the type of work that I do and in the community involvement. So Charles Richard Drew was an African-American physician known for pioneering work in blood reservation. So that was what he was very known for. Very talented, inspirational figure. He got all kinds of accolades. He was the director of American Red Cross Blood Bank. During this time, this was you can call this like between the 30s and the 40s, the early 30s and 40s. So he protested against the practice of racial segregation of the donation of blood. That was one of the things that he did. He was also the first African-American surgeon to serve as examiner of the American Board of Surgery. And then his accolades also exceeded medical education. So he also was quite athletic. So he achieved recognition on the football and track field too as well. So I shared some similarities with him, our interests with him as far as wanting to bridge the gap of racial disparity. And then as well as some of the values that he held as far as like giving back to the community. And then also the sports that I was speaking to a little bit earlier. So those are some of the things that that kind of interest me. So like his story, his preservation and his values are obviously reflected in the namesake of the project that I'm working on, which is Charles R. Drew University. So right now for the university, right, I would say, let me give you a quick history on how the university kind of came into play. So during the 60s, there was a uprising all across the U.S. related to racial disparity and racial issues. At this time, the Watts community, which is in South Los Angeles, the Watts community experienced an uprising of its own, actually called the Watts Rebellion or Watts Revolt. It's going under several different names, but one of the factors of the matter that was cited as kind of leading to this uprising was that lack of access to healthcare and lack of access to affordable healthcare and all the health disparities in the local community was cited as a major contributing factor. So all these factors led to the birth of Charles R. Drew University. They realized that, okay, if we educate the community and we train up locals to give back to their community and educate others, this is kind of ties into what I was saying about knowledge is wealth, that it winds up tying back into the community and the community can build that generational wealth that's shared from generation to generation. So this project in itself, as I mentioned, I hold dear just because one, it brings in, we're working on a medical education building that will train up doctors in their first 2 years of training. So M1 and M2 is what they call them. And cohorts. So this is where they basically learn the basics of how to become a doctor. And also they start to train as far as like simulate the environments in which they will be practicing. So you have simulation of hospital environments and simulation of your standardized doctor-patient relationship too as well. So the project is located in the Willowbrooks area, which is south of Watts. And this particular university School of Medicine offers the first school of medicine within the South Los Angeles region. So it offers the opportunity to get back to a region of LA that's historically shown to be that there's some disparities there as far as compared to other regions of LA. So this project is definitely offered up a new opportunity to one, give back to the community and educate the community and also build upon kind of my life goal, I should say, of building, helping to build or being part of building generational wealth from a knowledge standpoint and sharing your knowledge.
That's amazing. How did you guys get selected? Were you part of that process?
Yes, I was part of the process. So given our experience, we have a breadth of experience in the office as far as like we have a pretty diverse portfolio. We work a lot in healthcare industry. We work with medical education projects. We work with higher ed. We also do a lot of science and lab work. So the university actually reached out to us and engaged us. And one of the factors was that they wanted to reach out to firms that were diverse. So Co-Architects in itself, which is another reason in which I kind of selected Co-Architects and I was aware of Co-Architects, was the diversity approach. So we have approximately 160 employees. That's across two offices. So we have the Los Angeles office, which is the majority of our employees are here. And then we also have a smaller office in San Diego. And so we have employees from over 23 countries. We are 54% actually women. And then we also are a woman-led firm too as well. So diversity was one of the key things in which was a part of the selection process and then also breadth of experience. So that's kind of how we got part of that process. And I myself was part of the pursuit team, along with a few of my other colleagues. And so that experience and just sharing in one thing, the diversity of our firm, but also sharing in the diversity of our portfolio too. And that kind of helped us to win the project.
How do you like healthcare?
Healthcare is interesting. Beforehand, most of my work had been focused on education projects. So a lot of K through 12 and then some higher education projects as far as doing work for private and public universities. Now, healthcare is, I like the fact that it's educating people upon, this is something that, at least what I realize in the South, is that in the South, we tended not to prioritize. And I think it's important to do so, just knowing how to build that knowledge of health. And then also the fact that health can translate not only from like just a physical standpoint, but because health goes beyond that. Health goes as far as like mental health too, as well, as far as just focusing on those things. So the industry in itself is unique. And I'm a sponge for new things. So the Charles Drew University project that I'm leading, this particular project allows me to gain further knowledge within the industry. And so I'm literally just learning new terminologies, new things, and it's been quite eventful. But going back to your question about health things, I'm enjoying the process. I'm definitely enjoying the process of learning about it.
Because I've always been like, there's like a whole, I'm like, there's a whole industry. Of course, there's a whole industry. But it's just like, I don't know, it's like a whole different world. K through 12, I come from like a federal background, Department of Defense, Department of like all that stuff. Like that's the majority of my background. So that has its own set of rules, own set of regulations, all that stuff. You have like a K through 12 background as well. So when I think of like healthcare, I'm thinking of like ambulatory and bed sizes and like special mechanical systems and like, you know, building all that stuff, clinics and then you have to coordinate, but like with consultants, everything. So I was just curious regarding about that stuff.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, it's very technical as opposed to what some of the previous types of work that I've done. So just things related to code, things related to city and county approvals, and then as well as just you have to, we like to, here at Co-Architects, we like to understand, in order to fully develop what the client and understand the client's need is, you have to understand. Well, part of it is just understanding the program and understanding how the program works. So here at Co-Architects, we've become big advocates as far as involving ourselves to understand the curriculum. So it's bigger than just understanding, okay, I need to provide a patient bed here, or I need to provide a head wall and all these related equipments to the head wall, or I need to provide an exam desk here. Part of it, which makes it very technically driven, is that sometimes, given maybe say budget constraints and things related to that, there's a myriad of issues that can help delineate and help formulate or come to an fruition the or confirm the program. So the curriculum is a big part of it. If we understand the curriculum, that's part of understanding the client's needs. And then as well as if we can do that, and that can kind of help inform us how we lay out our building.
One of the things that you said earlier I want to talk about is your draw again back to California, because I've been there maybe like a handful of times, and I've been in like LA twice, San Francisco twice, and then I've been to Portland twice and Seattle once, and that was like an overnight thing. I don't even know if like that even counts. But one thing that surprised me, because I'm an East Coast, like Northeast, DC, Maryland. I've been up like all the way up to Vermont, and I've been to New Orleans, like that's it. But East Coast is old, right? You got a lot of brick, you got a lot of, you know, small, because people were like tiny, I guess, back in the 1800s. I don't know. But, you know, like the small size rooms versus like West Coast is more sprawl, and like things, not to say things are like McMansions or anything, although you can't get that but it's more avant-garde. When I look at West Coast architecture, I think of all glass or just more playful approach. What are your thoughts about, like, just comparing where you grew up, even like school and the stuff that you studied, to like where you're working at in your environment now?
Right. And honestly, I think there's beauty in both, because I think cultures and the cultural aspect should always play a part in the development of the architecture. So we always, at least in my mind, I think some of the great architects kind of pay attention to that, as far as just like, if I'm going to design something, I'm not just going to go there and plop in a building and design it the way I want it to look, right? You want to make sure you have community context. You want to make sure you have cultural context. You want to make sure that the building is essentially bettering the environment. So just the thought process of what I'm kind of getting at, as I mentioned, I do think there's beauty in both. So the traditional architecture, although it's not necessarily my style, but the traditional architecture of back home has its functions, right? So for instance, in the South, you have these long shotgun homes, but it's because like the environment plays a part in shaping the building, in which you may want to deal with natural ventilation through your building. And then on the West Coast, we have a lot of glass because it rarely rains in California, right? So key and song. Also, we have a lot of views in which, as far as like the changes in elevation here, that you may want to take advantage of some of the views. So honestly, I just find that there's beauty in both. And wherever you may go, you can find beauty in architecture. It may not necessarily jive with my style sometimes, but I always find a beauty in architecture, just knowing that and then seeing how the architecture embodies itself within its local context, as far as related to its adjacent building, or even in as far as just from the larger perspective and from the urban scale too, how the building kind of fits in there. But beauty in both.
Another thing that you mentioned earlier is wealth and wealth disparities. I know that, and you also mentioned that has a huge range, right? Not just monetary. Do you want to go? I can feed you some things, or did you have something specifically in mind?
I can, I think specifically, I'm just talking about like just the gap of knowledge when you go to like a well-off area of a city, as opposed to, I say, the inner city. I mean, that's a huge, huge gap from a knowledge standpoint. So I could potentially go into that and talk on that too.
Yeah. So what do you mean by knowledge? I guess let's start off with that.
So what is knowledge? So knowledge could be things as simple as you could have wealth, you could have financial wealth, but how do you get it? How do you maintain it? Those are some points as far as just how do you maintain, like, essentially, let me think of it from a community standpoint, as far as like when you have your inner city versus the cities that are contrary to, right? So in the inner cities, quite often, sometimes you see the placement. I'm thinking about it from an urban context. You see the placement of, you have your McDonald's, you have all the fast foods, you have all the things that are not healthy for you, right? In these particular areas, for instance, and just the knowledge, and as I understand, as I've kind of grown into the person I am today, like I realized that, okay, something really has to change here. You know, I guess knowledge is power, right? So things that you don't know, you just don't know. You don't know how to make amends and utilize information. But information is, I think information can be looked at as an asset, right? So when I get into like just knowledge and knowledge sharing, I don't mean just from a financial support of things, but if we can build up each other, right? Build up each other. And if we can share in our successes, like, so the things that I know that have made me successful are the things that someone else may have learned that made them successful. Why not share in that? And why not bring that to you? Not only just to your local community, but just other communities as well. You don't need to just share that information just with your local community, but your local community is obviously a place to start. But I think that's something that I don't see enough of, or at least in my experience, I haven't seen enough of, is just sharing in your success and things that make you successful. And then also just sharing in, like, for instance, I could speak in particular to architecture, right? When I was in school, K through 12 school, secondary school, what I was learning was that, what I didn't know, at least I should say, was that most of the understanding of, if you would have asked me at that age, what was architecture, if I didn't have my knowledge, right? This question typically got asked of a lot of my friends. And even to this day, people think architect is just drawing and coloring and making pretty pictures, right? So I think just sharing, like for instance, sharing the knowledge of what architecture is, I could speak into that particular point, like bringing that knowledge back home. I found now by doing what I just did, bringing that knowledge of and sharing the knowledge of just maybe doing a couple conferences or meetings with local schools saying like, hey, if you're interested in architecture, this is what it is. Just sharing that knowledge, I could have found the next architect or the next starchitect, you know? So I think just sharing that knowledge, and it benefits not only yourself, but it also benefits, I mean, I'm going to a bigger picture here, but it benefits everyone, right?
Right.
That's how I look at it.
You made a good point in the fact that architects or even architecture isn't really out there like it should be. And how you grew up, if it wasn't for your dad, like you mentioned, you wouldn't even know about architecture and, you know, all the experiences that you live with your dad. And so you see things all the time and you have conversations and stuff. And not everybody is privileged to have their dad around to teach them that stuff or to show them or just to bring that up, you know. And I just feel that architects do a horrible job in saying who they are and promoting who they are, what they do. And, you know, there are programs out there, you know, like NOMA has Project Pipeline and there's an ACE mentoring program out there. But that's just so far and few between because, again, you have to be lucky to even know about it or somebody to show like a student or whatever. And even as an adult, there are people's perception, like you mentioned earlier, of what architects do and so forth. And I think it's also, you know, part of this podcast, too, just to have, you know, Black and brown folks even talk about architecture, you know, like your dad looks like you, you know, like you know what I mean? And because you had that NOMA's group in college and, you know, now you're connected with other Black and brown architects out there. So we're like in this bubble. And you don't see us having conversations like this, talking about buildings and talking about you more or less like seeing someone that don't look like us to have these conversations. So, yeah, I think you do make an excellent point in the fact that we do need to get out there and stuff. Now, going to the McDonald's stuff, where were you going with that?
So where I was going with that was just that the fact that it seems that in a context that we need to, I feel like there needs to be a knowledge sharing saying like, hey, this is, you know, setting things up this way is not okay to me. And you say architecture is political, so maybe I should get political. I don't know.
That's what I love, you know, like that's why I brought it up. And I had this conversation with somebody is like, many podcasts ago, and you know, she's an older woman, so she remembers going to McDonald's in like the 70s, and like it was like a family affair. You know, you go to McDonald's with your family because you know, burgers were like 10 cents, and burgers were actually made out of real meat. You know, the fries, they had potatoes, it was real stuff. Fast forward to now. You get 10% beef. You're like, what happened? What's in the 90%? Like, you know, like what is that? But, and then even like, you know, post pandemic, like I went through, I was craving McDonald's fries the other day. So I went through the drive through and I was just like, a Happy Meal is like $6. If I wanted,
it's like $8. It's California though.
But still, like, it used to be affordable. Now, if I want a Big Mac, that's $12. $12. I could have went to Chipotle and get something healthier for that same amount of price. So nowadays, it's like, I work in Baltimore City. So I see a lot of Dollar Generals and Family Dollars and Popeyes and, you know,
check cash in places.
Right, right. You see all these things. And then if I go by the harbor, I get like Sweet Green and all these other things. And I ask myself, like, why do I have to travel 20 minutes away to get something fresh? And even if I go to grocery store, there's like a grocery store. You guys have Safeway, right?
Yes, we do have Safeway, yeah.
Okay, so like I went to Safeway and I was like, oh, well, you know, for work, I was like, oh, let me just buy a bag of tangerines and put it on my desk or if I want a snack or whatever. Them jokes was like $9 for a bag of tangerines. $9, son.
It's crazy what you got to do to eat healthy.
Right, right.
Eating healthy shouldn't cost you is what I'm kind of getting at, but it seems that like what's been placed in, let's say, in our local communities is that all the things that are not healthy. So what I'm saying is like knowledge is power, right? Just interjecting ourselves and letting people know like, hey, this probably we can change things is what I'm kind of getting at. I've always been the advocate for that, advocate for change. Things should always be in motion and things should always change for the better. But we should be okay with saying like, look, we don't want just these things in our local communities. You can give us a Whole Foods. You can give us a Sweet Greens, you know, like what's the issue with that? You know, so it's just, I'm sure there are other factors at play, but just things related to that is what I'm kind of getting at as far as just it's important to spread that knowledge and understanding. And then that way we can say, look, this is not okay. We can make the change or at least put in motion the change.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's crazy because it really is an uphill battle. It really is an uphill battle. I mean, I've seen communities in Baltimore City where they don't want this Dollar General, another Dollar General here or another Family Dollar because it devalues the community. You know, why do we even need that? And I mean, the food selection is horrible. Like the stuff that they sell is horrible. And to say that it's cheap is like, you know, it's questionable to say the least. They want to put these things in certain neighborhoods and we're like saying, no, we don't want them in our neighborhoods. And it's really, it's always a fight for whatever reason, unfortunately.
Yeah, I know that's always a tough go, but I think it's one of those things where, you know, change doesn't happen overnight. So it's just like, but if you keep pressing upon the issue, let it not be forgotten, right? The issue at hand. I think those are some of the important things to kind of take in. Mm-hmm. That the fact that we keep pressing upon wanting to make change, because that's the only way change gets done is if you keep bringing it up, keep bringing it up, keep bringing it up. So that's how my mind works, at least.
So as we wrap up here, what's next for you? Like what how you see yourself in the next 5 years? Or, you know, are you forever a California resident?
I have my son and daughter out here, so I have to think about their education experience. So that's going to always drive where I go, because like I always want to be part of their lives. So wherever I can find a good education for them, and then wherever I can find affordable housing that's not in California so far. The next steps for me, like is that's part of it. Just making sure that my family's good. Career-wise, eventually I see myself maybe here at Code one day becoming a principal and being involved in that side of things and getting more involved in that side of how to help run a firm. And then also just like I can see myself doing maybe bigger things, maybe even outside of the firm as far as just making those connections outside of it as far as just becoming more active and involved in my community and connecting like-minded people and also people that just look like you and I as far as just bringing them into the industry and just kind of keeping that pipeline going so that we can also share in the influence on the physical and built environment. So that's kind of like the next immediate steps that I kind of want to, I say immediate, but it could be long-term too. but anyway, I'm a profess. That is not as long-term as I see it currently. But those are some of the things that that I kind of foresee and that I would like to have career-wise and family-wise.
Well, thank you so much, Ren, for coming on. It was fun.
Yeah, it was definitely fun. Hopefully we get a chance to connect again.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to Architecture's Political Podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode and found it informative or at least entertaining. If you like what you heard, please share with others. You can also connect with Arcus Poly on social media, currently on Instagram as well as Facebook and Twitter. For more information, visit us on our website. It's arcuspoly.online, arcuspoly.online. I also want to thank our loyal supporters who have been with this podcast for at least 3 years. It means the world to me, and I'm totally grateful to have you part of this community. I will try to bring you the best content as possible, and I can't wait to share more amazing episodes with you. If this is your first time listening, or just like a particular episode, or all of them, you can support this podcast by going on glow.fm/arcuspoly. Again, thank you for your support. It means the world to me, and thank you so much for listening.